POV, it's 1977. Inflation is as high as it ever got in 2022, and it's been like that for 5 years with no end in sight. America is still reeling from the end of the Vietnam War, the first war the US ever clearly lost. At the same time, the government has suffered a collapse in confidence in the wake of the Watergate scandal. The president is no longer a figure of universal respect. Democrats hold supermajorities in the House and Senate, the most recent time either party had a supermajority in either chamber, but even still, they're having trouble passing legislation. The Equal Rights Amendment, a constitutional amendment guaranteeing gender equality, is facing a national backlash and now looks unlikely to pass. In some American cities, crime is rising to levels never seen before. A 25-hour blackout just hit New York, causing a wave of looting and rioting that may have been the closest real-life event to the Purge. Some music historians claim that smash-and-grab robberies of stereos from appliance stores during the blackout helped start hip-hop, though a lot of early rappers understandably dispute this. Amid all of this, the USSR announces that a new flu strain circulating in eastern Russia may cause a pandemic. In this POV, you're living a fairly privileged life, sheltered from all of this, because you are Johnny Carson, the host of The Tonight Show. 4 nights a week, millions of Americans tune in to watch. You regularly top lists of the most admired people in the country, and your show's ratings are unparalleled. One night, you're in your dressing room when a member of your entourage comes up to you and hands you a cassette. You ask him what this is. He responds, "Someone wrote a song about you. You should hear it." You plug in the cassette, and this is what you hear.
He sits behind his microphone. Johnny Carson.
So, how do you react? Presumably, you react the way the real Johnny Carson did. You're a little weirded out. It's a weird song no matter how you look at it. Maybe you find it charming. Maybe you picture some awkward group of theater kids in middle America hacking away at a cheap keyboard trying to earn a trip to The Tonight Show for their school choir in the bluntest way possible, by writing a song kissing Johnny Carson's ass. But would you believe, having just heard this song, that it's by a well-known band? A band you've definitely heard of, whether you're Johnny Carson in 1977 or yourself in the 21st century? Would you believe that it's by the Beach Boys? I'm your host, Tor Parsons. These are my co-hosts, Jalebi the Durian and Thimble the Doll, and welcome to Tor's Cabinet of Curiosities.
And it's Friday, so we've got fan art, or as some of the folks on the Discord have begun calling it, fart. The members of the Discord really have been farting up a storm lately. There is just a cloud of fart around the Discord. So we got this one by Gia, seems to be our first crossover between Tor's Cabinet characters and other characters, a moment of sexual tension between Jalebi and Garfield. Thank you, Gia. We got this fantastic long hair, short hair, in the cabinet triple portrait by Spencer. We got Jolly Bucks, also by Spencer. Excellent, excellent. We got Thimble with a straight razor. Fantastic, by Moonsider. I love this so much because in my Q&A episode, I said that Thimble's inspiration, the original D&D character I have, that Thimble is based on. Thimble at all fights with a straight razor. So someone illustrated that. Love it so much. Thank you, Moonsider. The fans are even farting in ways it didn't occur to me you could fart. Like this Duriandolier built by Zuzu, which is incredible. Thank you ever so much. Another work by Spencer, in which I look like Luigi Mangione, and one by Duke, in which I look like Dr. Bunsen Honeydew from the Muppets. That has been Fan Art Friday. To submit fan art, you join the Tours Cabinet Discord. To join the Tours Cabinet Discord, you contribute to the Tours Cabinet Patreon. Link in description. Thank you so much, all of you, and on with the show.
In late middle school and early high school, I went through a phase where I was seriously obsessed with the Beach Boys. Really obsessed with the Beach Boys. For a time, it may have been one of the few things that has ever displaced trains as my first and foremost special interest. You know, the Beach Boys. The quintessential Southern California fun in the sun band. The band that sang about their teenage dreams of surfing, driving hot rods, and being true to your school. The band that made the most critically acclaimed album of all time, according to the site Acclaimed Music. The only band that the Beatles considered their legitimate rivals in the mid-60s, and who allegedly inspired the Beatles to make their legendary 1967 album Sgt. Pepper out of fear that the Beach Boys would usurp their title as the most innovative band in the world. The only American artist that can rival David Bowie in the terms of their decades-long, consistently innovative, genre-spanning discography. If those last few statements land a long way from your image of the Beach Boys, I don't blame you. If you're not a music nerd who's intensely familiar with the ins and outs of the Beach Boys' long art rock period, you can be forgiven for thinking of them as in and out the band. The name doesn't do them any favors. It's damn hard to shake off your image as a band that just does lighthearted beach party music when you're called the Beach Boys. Imagine, if the Beatles had been called the Mop Tops, would they have been able to stay popular when they moved beyond their Mop Tops and teen love songs phase? Would OK Computer have been taken seriously if Radiohead was just called Nirvana Light? Consider a world in which, instead of breaking up in 2015, One Direction put out an adventurous experimental album that nobody listened to, and have released a string of weird, interesting artistic albums since then, but they're still only famous for their teen heartthrob years, and everyone still thinks they broke up sometime around 2015. That's a little bit like what the real-life perception of the Beach Boys is. So, who really were the Beach Boys? The Beach Boys were formed in Hawthorne, California, a suburb of Los Angeles near the airport, in 1961. They consisted of the Wilson brothers, Brian, Carl, and Dennis, the Wilsons' cousin, Mike Love, and their friend Al Jardine. A sixth member named Bruce Johnston later joined in 1965. Mike was intended to be the frontman, but the bassist Brian Wilson was clearly the brains of the group, by far the most talented musician and the main songwriter, so he was usually treated as the band's leader by the press. Initially, they were called the Pendletones, a reference to their stage uniform of Pendleton Woolen Mills sweaters, favored by surfers. When they got their first record deal, though, they received the unwelcome surprise that their single Surfin' was instead being sold under the name The Beach Boys, a name none of them liked and none of them were consulted on. But the single was a hit, and they didn't want to bite the hand that was beginning to feed them. For the next few years, they did what they're still best known for today. They sang about sexy cars and sexy girls, with layered harmonies and reverb guitars, and defined the cultural image of California and 60s beach culture. Most of the Beach Boys songs you know come from this era. Surfin' USA, I Get Around, California Girls, Fun Fun Fun, etc. But Brian Wilson was getting sick of songs about sun and surfing. For all the Beach Boys' outgoing party animal image, Brian was introverted, possibly autistic, obsessed with music production and arranging techniques, and would rather have spent a day tinkering with sounds in a studio than surfing or picking up girls. By 1965, the Beatles had met Bob Dylan and were starting to do adventurous things with their music. Brian wanted to steer the Beach Boys in the same direction. This set up a conflict that goes on to this day with his bandmate Mike Love. Mike liked the Beach Boys' beachy image and was perplexed by the new, more experimental songs Brian was beginning to write. Mike thought Brian was a pretentious wannabe artist. Brian thought Mike was just in it for the money and groupies and had no real passion for music. They have never buried the hatchet. Both of them are still alive and they hate each other. Things have mellowed since the 1980s, when they were rumored to have had a restraining order against each other, but Brian is still posting on social media urging fans to boycott the shows that Mike is still playing today under the Beach Boys' name. But the Brian-Mike feud, which is the stuff of legend among fans, was yet to really heat up in the mid-60s, and Brian won that round. After all, the other members weren't really maturing as songwriters quite yet. Without Brian, there would be no Beach Boys songs, so they pretty much had to do what Brian wanted to do. And what he wanted to do was catch up with Dylan and the Beatles and make darker, more topical, more sophisticated music. From this point on, it's hard not to think of Brian Wilson's life as some sort of Greek tragedy. It seems to be a recurring theme that everything he does to promote himself as a legitimate musician ends up working briefly and then backfiring spectacularly. In 1966, the Beach Boys released what is by far their most critically acclaimed album, and once again, according to some sources, the most critically acclaimed album of all time, Pet Sounds. You may not have ever listened to this album, but the name might ring a bell. Anyone who's seriously into music knows Pet Sounds. Every major music magazine and blog has run retrospectives on why it's one of the greatest albums ever made, and the half-century-long love fest for Pet Sounds has gotten so intense that there was even a Portlandia skit about it.
This one's great. They use this kind on Pet Sounds. You know Pet Sounds. Come on. Amps. It's like 1962.
In the music verse, Pet Sounds has gotten so big that when Love and Mercy, a biopic about the making of Pet Sounds, starring Paul Dano as Brian Wilson, came out in 2014, there were all these contrarian takes being written, shooting down the sacred cow of Pet Sounds, saying things like, well, actually, it's not actually that innovative, and maybe your beloved Brian Wilson is a pretentious asshole like Mike Love thinks he is, and so on. And look, if you've got an Amish-style beard and a framed vinyl copy of In the Aeroplane Over the Sea on your wall, you can debate all you want about whether Pet Sounds deserves to be so revered. But this podcast isn't for the Anthony Fantanos of the world. If you're normal about music, and it's good to be normal about music, these two things are the two things worth remembering about Pet Sounds. Number one, it's sometimes considered the greatest album of all time, among the type of people who make lists of the greatest albums of all time. And two, most people have never heard of it, except its opening track, Wouldn't It Be Nice, and aren't really aware that the Beach Boys did music as moody and sophisticated as most of the rest of the record is. So, what was so unique about Pet Sounds? A lot of things, but the key element that set Pet Sounds apart from previous Beach Boys albums is that it was effectively a Brian Wilson solo album. Brian conducted an army of session musicians playing nearly every conceivable instrument for the album's arrangements. The other Beach Boys were sidelined, usually only appearing as backup singers. Even then, Brian demanded take after take after take, insisting that he was making an album that would dethrone the Beatles, and everything had to be absolutely perfect. Laying down the vocals for one track took a week of all-day recording. When Pet Sounds was released, it got Brian Wilson immediate attention from critics as well as fellow musicians, but audiences and the other members of the Beach Boys were bemused, and it didn't sell as well as the band's previous surfing and summer-themed albums. Brian hired Derek Taylor, the Beatles' former publicist, to change the public image of the Beach Boys, letting audiences know that they were leaving surf rock behind them. Taylor planted articles in top music magazines of the day announcing, quote, Brian Wilson is a genius. He compared Brian to Bach and Mozart, comparisons he knew were ridiculous, but he hoped would at least help move the needle toward Brian being known as a serious songwriter, rather than the guy from that silly surfing band, especially as Brian embarked on his next project. As 1967 dawned, Brian, emboldened by the genius rhetoric and his new use of psychedelic drugs, began to work on an even more ambitious album. It was going to be called Smile, and it was going to be as much an improvement over Pet Sounds as Pet Sounds had been over their old surf rock material. Brian called it a teenage symphony to God. Moving on from Pet Sounds' emotional, personal lyrics, Smile was going to be a kaleidoscopic multi-concept concept album about life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, California, the history of American music, coming of age, and more, all tied together into a single 45-minute LP. Part of Smile was going to have a narrative about American colonization and the decimation of the Native Americans. Later on, there was going to be a series of songs about raising a child, and a set of four tracks symbolizing the four classical elements, earth, air, fire, and water, with fire being represented by a cacophony of slide whistles imitating sirens. The album was supposed to center on a little song called Good Vibrations. Yes, that Good Vibration.
I'm picking up good vibrations. She's giving me the excitations.
Now, you definitely know Good Vibrations. Even today, it's probably the Beach Boys' signature song, and because it's sunny and energetic and shares some of its qualities with their earlier surf rock stuff, it doesn't really challenge the image of the Beach Boys as blandly likable beach bums. But Good Vibrations is way more complicated than any of the Beach Boys' other hits. It's layered, it takes a lot of unexpected left turns, and how many other feel-good pop songs do you know that have a theremin on them? Now, Good Vibrations was supposed to present a path forward for the Beach Boys as a pop band and a serious band. Co-written by Brian Wilson and Mike Love, it was accessible enough that Mike liked it and adventurous enough that Brian liked it. It had mass appeal and artistic appeal, and when it was released as the first single from Smile, it became a huge hit. Smile still wasn't finished when Good Vibrations was released, though, and the success of Good Vibrations just turned up the heat on Brian. Before Good Vibrations, the music press was waiting with bated breath for the Beach Boys' next album, which was promised to be revolutionary, but the record-buying public had largely forgotten about the Beach Boys. Now, though, the whole world was watching, Everyone wanted to hear the supposedly earth-shattering new Beach Boys album that Good Vibrations had come from, but back home in California, Brian was running out of ideas. A few months later, as the planned release date for Smile retreated further off into the future, the Beach Boys released another single to tide fans over, Heroes and Villains, a sort of Wild West operetta curiosity that Brian claimed was better than Good Vibrations.
I've been in this town so long, the vacuum city I've been taking for lost.
Nobody agreed. Critics and audiences were perplexed. The Smile sessions had already been falling apart amid Brian's mounting mental health struggles and Mike Love considering most of the album way too weird, but the failure of the Heroes and Villains single was the nail in the coffin. Smile was abandoned and left unfinished, and with it, Brian's dreams of eclipsing the Beatles died. The band was still contractually obliged to release an album in 1967, though, so they slapped together Smiley Smile, a half-assed half-hour consisting of Good Vibrations, Heroes and Villains, a few extremely stoned lo-fi re-recordings of songs intended for Smile, and a bunch of repetitive filler tracks. Smiley Smile is the worst attempt at 60s psychedelic rock you will ever hear. Today, it has its fair share of vocal defenders, and that's valid. The whole 90s lo-fi twee pop era wouldn't exist without Smiley Smile, and I love that music, but at the time it was released, nobody liked it. Not Brian, not Mike, not the other Beach Boys, not critics, and definitely not audiences. Good Vibrations got the world thinking the Beach Boys were on the cusp of a renaissance, where they really might rival the Beatles in terms of both vision and popularity. Smiley Smile made it clear that that was not going to happen. Today, Smile is the stuff of legend, the sort of thing that's spoken about in hushed tones among a certain type of music nerd. If it had been finished and released, some people say, the entire world of pop music would have been changed forever. The history of rock and roll wouldn't be quite as monotheistic, with the Beatles considered head and shoulders above everyone else in the traditional rock historiography. Other artists would have emerged in the wake of Smile that wouldn't sound anything like the artists that hit it big in our time. Or maybe not. Maybe Smile would just have been ignored by the mainstream and develop a cult following not much larger than the cult following it has in real life. We don't know what the finished album would have sounded like, after all. There are a lot of mixes on YouTube that aim to reconstruct what Smile might have sounded like had it been released, stitching together various bootleg tracks from the Smile sessions. Most of them follow more or less the same track list, but I don't know if the popular sequencing is something Brian actually had in mind or if it's just fanon. And given that hours and hours of music were recorded for Smile, but it was intended to be whittled down to an album no longer than one LP, we really have no way of knowing what would have been kept and what wouldn't. Brian Wilson was never really the same after the failure of Smile. His increasing drug use, the impossible expectations raised by his branding as a genius, and the opposition of his bandmates to his musical experimentation all did a number on him, and his role in the Beach Boys began shrinking. Over the next few years, the Beach Boys put out a series of albums on which all six band members contributed roughly equally, and the production was credited to the Beach Boys as a whole rather than just Brian. The rest of the band enjoyed this era, because after Smiley Smile, the music world had stopped caring about them, so they decided they would stop caring about the music world. There's a lot of good stuff on these albums, and a lot of bad stuff, and it's neither experimental nor surf rock. I've described the sound of this era as eclectic, soul-influenced hippie folk rock. None of the Beach Boys' late 60s albums sold well, which they were kind of okay with, being out of the public eye and all. The best album of the Beach Boys' leaderless collective era is usually considered to be Sunflower, 1970, an album whose overall folk-pop sound compares pretty nicely to the Beatles' Rubber Soul. All six members of the Beach Boys wrote at least one song on Sunflower, and all of them sang lead on at least one song. Some critics consider it the Beach Boys' best album after Pet Sounds, and yeah, by conventional musical beauty standards, it's definitely a solid album, although I'd plump for a different, more unusual album, which I'll spend the second half of this episode talking about. So, Sunflower was a good album, but when it was released, its sales and critical attention could be rounded down to roughly zero. After Sunflower, the Beach Boys decided they were sick of being out of the public eye and hired a new manager, a guy called Jack Riley, giving him the unenviable task of restoring the Beach Boys to stardom. Riley's advice was threefold: write socially conscious lyrics, focus on the old days, and sideline Brian. The first recommendation was carried out to disastrous results on the 1971 album Surf's Up, an album that, despite its title, wasn't a return to the surf rock days. Instead, it included protest songs bluntly addressing air pollution, water pollution, and anti-Vietnam War riots, letting the world know that the Beach Boys were not built for writing protest songs. Never mind, thanks to Riley's promotion, Surf's Up still charted higher than any other Beach Boys album in years, though it couldn't really be called a hit. Other than the ham-handed protest songs, it's a damn good album. In fact, it included some of the best songs the Beach Boys ever came out with. Long Promised Road, Till I Die, Feel Flows, Disney Girls, but they're alongside some of the worst songs they ever came out with. It's super inconsistent. The other recommendations made sense to the band. Revisiting the songs everyone knew the Beach Boys for sounded reasonable, and as much as it hurt the other band members to admit it, Brian was becoming withdrawn and wasn't really fit for the spotlight. He had developed a strange obsession with health food, even writing songs about it, despite weighing 300 pounds because of a worsening overeating problem. He rarely left his LA mansion and rarely wore anything but a bathrobe. His once choir boy pure voice had been ruined by chain-smoking 4 packs a day. His contributions to Beach Boys albums were getting more off-putting too. Either 1, extremely blunt and emotionally raw, or 2, eerily childlike. For example, his main contribution to the 1973 album Holland was a surreal 12-minute spoken word children's story about a magic man who lives inside a transistor radio. Around the same time, unrelated to Brian, 3, the band members began increasingly using Moog synthesizers, an early analog synth, although that didn't become a defining part of the band's sound yet. Remember those 3 things for later. That's foreshadowing. So the Beach Boys went on tour without Brian, while Brian stayed back in LA, secluding himself in his house's chauffeur quarters, occasionally wandering around the city in his bathrobe, unrecognized, begging for drugs or alcohol. He developed an obsession with the folk song Shortenin' Bread, which he would play nonstop on his piano for hours and hours and hours. In 1974, the Beach Boys' former label, Capitol Records, released Endless Summer, a best-of compilation of their earlier surf-era songs. To everyone's surprise, except maybe Jack Riley's, it was a huge hit, becoming the first Beach Boys album in more than a decade to go number one. All of a sudden, people were listening to the Beach Boys again. There was demand for them to play stadium concerts. It would be a mistake to say the Beach Boys were cool again. They were already being considered a sort of a nostalgia act. But the Beach Boys were big again. It looked like the second and third bullet points of Jack Riley's strategy, look back on the Beach Bum days and push Brian ever further into the background, were paying off. But there was a catch. Most of the songs on Endless Summer had been written by Brian, and as interest in the Beach Boys rose again, so did interest in Brian. In fact, one of the main things the music press was saying about the Beach Boys was, whatever happened to Brian? If Brian had still been in charge of the band, the Beach Boys wouldn't have gone through that washed-up period. To anyone familiar with Brian's mental state at the time, this obviously wasn't true. He had to be watched over 24/7 by Mike Love's brother Stan, a 6'9 pro basketball player, to make sure he didn't do anything self-destructive. In 1975, the rest of the band rushed out an album called 15 Big Ones to capitalize on their resurgence in popularity, but although 15 Big Ones did sell better than any new Beach Boys album in years, it didn't get great reviews. About half of it was devoted to covers of 50s rock songs, and it barely had any contributions from Brian, even though he was officially credited as the album's producer in a half-hearted attempt at signaling he was back. The music world wasn't fooled. What critics said they wanted was new Beach Boys music, and specifically new Beach Boys music from Brian. As the 70s went on, the band realized they were in a catch-22. They were selling out arenas again, but they couldn't keep up their commercial success for much longer without getting good reviews for a new album. And to get good reviews for a new album, they'd need to put Brian in charge of it. But if they put Brian in charge of an album, it would definitely be weird and uncommercial. In 1976, the band members decided to take a chance on Brian. He said he was writing lots of new songs, and they all felt pretty sorry for the way they'd treated him in the years since Smile. His mental state had been improving for about a year, under the 24/7 care of the controversial psychotherapist Eugene Landy. So they drew a heavy sigh and gave Brian carte blanche to do whatever he wanted for the Beach Boys' next album. And here we get to what the rest of this episode will be about, because what he made was one of the weirdest, most challenging albums ever produced by a well-known mainstream artist, and made 1,000 times weirder by the fact that that artist was the Beach Boys.
I bet he's nice. I bet he's twice.
The Beach Boys' Love You was this album's name, and God, where do I start with this album? Like the Beach Boys' Pet Sounds' Smile era, this album has a cult following, but just like how people who are casually into the Beach Boys' hits probably don't know about Pet Sounds' reputation, even an appreciable number of Pet Sounds stans probably don't know about Love You. It's been called the Beach Boys' punk album, more in its quick and dirty DIY spirit than its sound, which is unlike anything you'll ever hear. It's been acclaimed by people who you definitely wouldn't think of as Beach Boys fans, like Patti Smith and Sonic Youth. One of the recording engineers who worked on it compared Brian Wilson making Love You to David Lynch making Eraserhead, and personally I'd go even further. I'd compare it to the work of Henry Darger, a similarly shut-in artist who made esoteric, soul-bearing, naive art. My friend Kinley, who's even more of a music nerd than I am, compared Love You's legacy to the album Trout Mask Replica by Captain Beefheart, another obscure album that sounds dissonant and off-putting to the casual listener, but has influenced an astounding number of musicians. Your first time hearing Love You, you're likely to think of it as something like a musical equivalent of Sonnet You. Like Sonnet You, it's sloppy, strange, reveals more than you'd like to know about its deranged creator's insecurities, and has a childlike atmosphere that can sometimes be downright creepy. But unlike Sonnet You, all those things make Love You a great work of art. Even though it's obviously by an established artist, I think Love You is worth considering outsider music. The last Beach Boys album to be this Brian-centric was Pet Sounds. One of the most distinctive features of Pet Sounds is how lush it is. During the Pet Sounds sessions, Brian conducted vast orchestras of session musicians, bringing in layers of guitars, woodwinds, strings, saxes, organs, percussion, all so meticulously mic'd and mixed that it's impossible to pick out a single instrument from the mix. Love You is the polar opposite. Bare bones, with early analog synths and lo-fi drum machines making up almost all the instruments on the album. It sounds exactly how you'd expect an album by a mentally ill, washed-up rock star locked in his room to sound. Love You is sometimes considered the first synth-pop album, or the first bedroom-pop album. It's been said that without Love You, there would have been no 80s new wave scene, and synthesizers would still be considered experimental effects pieces unfit for popular music. And the lyrics. Oh, those lyrics. Not only did Brian write all the music for the album, he wrote almost all the lyrics, too, which was not common for him. He wrote almost all the Beach Boys' music, from their founding up to the collapse of Smile, but he hardly ever wrote his own lyrics, with Mike Love as his usual writing partner until the two of them had their falling out, or sometimes a friend of the band named Roger Christian, not to be confused with the director of Battlefield Earth, also named Roger Christian. Even on Pet Sounds, otherwise a solo Brian project, Brian brought in a lyricist from outside the band, Tony Asher, to write most of the words, and most of Smile's complex, historically informed lyrics were written for Brian by singer-songwriter Van Dyke Parks. Love You is the only officially released Beach Boys album on which Brian wrote all his own lyrics, and it shows. Brian is not an accomplished lyricist, but all the awkward rhymes and unexpected song subjects on Love You just make it feel all the more real. Possibly for the first and only time in his entire music career, he was writing exactly what he was thinking, with zero interference from anybody else. His thoughts, his hopes, his fears, and his trivial day-to-day experiences went right into songs unfiltered. I doubt there are too many other works of art in any medium that offer such a direct look into the mind of a unique creator during a time of crisis. It's like Goya's black paintings with synthesizers and a song called Ding Dang. In other words, critics said they wanted to hear Brian, and boy, did they! Love You was released in 1977 to acclaim from critics and a gigantic what the fuck from fans. The band's record label prepared a media blitz to let the world know that Brian was back for real now, but the best press in the world couldn't have made this album a commercial success. In terms of technical proficiency, Love You is not a good album. It's rough and clumsy, Brian's smoker voice is annoying, his lyrics get really strange, tempos ricochet all over the place, and drums hit hilariously off. But it is a great album. 15 Big Ones, their previous album, had reached number 8 on the Billboard charts. Love You peaked way down at 53. But nobody remembers 15 Big Ones these days, whereas Love You has a dedicated following. REM guitarist Peter Buck considers it one of his favorite albums, and so does Alex Chilton. Lester Bangs and Robert Christgau, arguably the most influential music critics of all time, both considered Love You one of the best Beach Boys albums. A few members of the Beach Boys even consider it the best thing they've done, not even Brian. I mean, even from the album cover alone, you can tell that this isn't an average Beach Boys album. Look at that colorful, pixelated design. It was made by Dean Torrence, half of the surf rock duo Jan and Dean, who had been the Beach Boys' contemporaries and sometimes rivals in the early 60s. Torrence said his design for the cover art was inspired by Navajo blankets, but when I look at it, I see pixel art. The term pixel art wasn't really in use in 1977, so I'm willing to add that to the list of things Love You pioneered. It looks like the home screen for an 80s arcade machine. It looks like it should say press start across the bottom. And that's fitting, because parts of Love You, with their cheap synth sounds, come pretty close to sounding like classic video game music. Some genius on YouTube made an 8-bit version of this album. It doesn't sound too different from the original. When you do press start on Love You, as it were, this is what you hear. This isn't my favorite song, or even my favorite song on Love You, nor is it my favorite song to be at the beginning of an album, but it is my absolute favorite album opening track. There are better songs that happen to be the first song on an album, but I don't know of another album that hits the ground running quite as well. From the first few opening bars of Let Us Go On This Way, which is what this song is called, you have a pretty good mental picture of what this album is going to be. There's loud, aggressive synths, low-quality drums, weird lyrics about extrasensory perception, and then the chorus comes in and the harmonies remind you that against all odds, you're still listening to the Beach Boys. The lyrics also reference having a crush on a girl at school, which is almost as weird because Brian was in his late 30s at the time and probably hadn't been inside a school in decades. At least I certainly hope not. Brian later defended some of the eerily childlike lyrics on Love You by saying he was writing what the public wanted, believing that what the public wanted from the Beach Boys was simple songs about teen romance, which Love You doesn't actually have much of, but in the case of Let Us Go On This Way, I'll give him the benefit of the doubt. Let Us Go On This Way isn't autobiographical. It's pretty clear Brian just wanted to open the album with a direct, to-the-point love song. With an out-of-nowhere reference to ESP, of course. So, Let Us Go On This Way is weird, but the album really starts getting weird on the next track, Roller Skating Child, which is about a roller skating child. If you're starting to get creeped out, you've got the right idea. The girl in the lyrics never gets an exact age put on her, but I think from the description we're supposed to think she's about like 12. And then the chorus goes,
"You'll make sweet love when the sun goes down. We'll even do more when her mama's not around."
Uh-huh. Brian, what the fuck? Brian, what is going through your head? Roller Skating Child tends to be considered Exhibit A of the creepy, uncomfortably sexual lyrics on Love You, which there are a lot of, but I contest that. Most songs on Love You are either autobiographical, in which the narrator of the song is clearly Brian Wilson as he was in 1977, alone in his dilapidated mansion, or nostalgic, where Brian is singing in character as the old early 60s image of Brian Wilson. I'm not convinced Roller Skating Child has Brian singing as either version of himself. I think you're supposed to see the narrator of Roller Skating Child as a creep. In the lyrics, we hear about the titular child's laissez-faire parenting and how she seems to know that her relationship is not okay. She gives the narrator a devious wink. At the time, Brian claimed the song was made up of two ideas Frankenstein together. One, a song about taking his daughter's roller skating, and another that was more adult, but I think he was just trying to cover his ass. I think Brian knew exactly what he was doing. I think he was trying to write something like the book Lolita in the form of a 2-minute song. In fact, Brian almost never wrote about himself. Brian, like Charlie, don't surf. He never surfed a day in his life. Almost everything he ever wrote consisted of fantasies about other people's lives. And other than a few songs, which we will get to, that applies to Love You, too. Then we get to Mona. I've never heard a song that is simultaneously so 50s and so electronic at once. Now, I've already mentioned in passing in this episode that I think Brian Wilson is autistic. If he is, his main special interest isn't music in general, nor is it music production and arranging, it's Phil Spector specifically. Phil Spector was a pop music producer in the 1950s and 60s, best known for writing and producing a bunch of lavishly orchestrated hits by manufactured girl groups. There aren't a lot of well-known songs where the producer is better known than the artist, but early 60s classics like Be My Baby, Da Do Ron Ron, and You've Lost That Loving Feeling are probably better remembered today as Phil Spector songs than songs by the Ronettes, the Crystals, and the Righteous Brothers, respectively. Phil Spector's roller coaster of a life and career deserves an entire episode of its own. But what's worth remembering about Phil Spector now is that he made songs that sound like this, except with fewer synthesizers. And Brian Wilson was obsessed with him. The lush arrangements on Pet Sounds were Brian's attempt at imitating the style of Phil Spector, probably even more than they were an attempt at surpassing the Beatles. All the other Beach Boys members described Brian listening to Be My Baby, probably the most famous Spector song, over and over again, nonstop, for days. Lyrics-wise, Mona is mostly just about pining for a girl and taking her on a date, but it's also the only Beach Boys song in which Brian directly name-drops Phil Spector, who, despite all the synthesizers, is a very clear influence on this song's sound, much more so than any other song on Love You. I like to think that this song is a totally accurate recap of Brian taking a girl out on a date. At some point, as he gets to know her, he inevitably says, "Listen to Do Ron Ron now, listen to Be My Baby, I know you're gonna love Phil Spector." Autistic people, and anyone who spends time around autistic people, can relate. Every conversation eventually trends toward being about someone's special interest. Then, there's the Johnny Carson song, which you heard at the start of the episode. It's just a song about Johnny Carson. It's very direct, very earnest, and very much just about Johnny Carson. Some critics have searched for deeper meanings in this song, that it's about how Brian envies Johnny Carson for having stayed mentally stable in the spotlight, or for having a brand new show every week without ever suffering burnout, similarly to someone else I can name who has a brand new show every week without ever suffering burnout. But I don't think Brian was thinking any of that. I think it's like how babies, when they're just learning to talk, name things based on what's on their mind at that exact moment. What's your Furby called, Malachi? Malachi is a total infant name to me. Well, Malachi's also playing with his rubber shark right now, so from then on, the Furby is called Shark Furby. I think the Johnny Carson song came from a similar place. Brian wakes up in the middle of the night, snorts a line of coke, switches on his Moog synthesizer, none of which are things babies should be doing. By the way, drugs are a gateway to analog electronic music. And he decides to write a song. What is he going to write a song about? He turns on the TV, and there's Johnny Carson. Sure, he'll write a song about Johnny Carson. After Johnny Carson, Love You takes a momentary vacation from being weird, which, as you understand, is all the more weird. The next song, Good Time, is noticeably different from the rest of the album in every possible way. From just the opening drum taps alone, you can tell that this song is much more complicatedly arranged than all the other songs we've heard so far. It has bass harmonicas and a brass band on it, and wait a minute! Brian's singing voice is clear, and isn't gruff anymore. As you can guess, Good Time was recorded long before the rest of Love You. It was originally intended for the Beach Boys' aforementioned 1970 album Sunflower, but left off it along with a lot of other outtakes that would surface on other albums or bootleg tapes over the course of the 70s. Why Good Time ended up being released on Love You, I don't think anyone knows, especially since it sticks out like a sore thumb amid the album's extremely distinctive sound. But if we're going off its lyrics, I think Good Time would stick out even more on Sunflower. Most of Sunflower consists of sweet, simple love songs or hippie flower power anthems. Good Time is a lot more cynical, saying blunt and objectifying things about a bunch of hopefully fictional women and celebrating a sort of live fast, die young mentality. It even has some of Love You's ever so special, awkward sexual lyrics. Good Time isn't one of Love You's better moments, I think, although it is one of the more commercially viable songs. It doesn't come from the same headspace that Brian was in when he was writing everything else on the album. It's just a mid, fairly sexist Beach Boys song from a different era. Then, the album dives back into its usual sound with both feet. Brian Wilson, addicted to coke and synthesizers, making what he thinks are charming bubblegum teen pop songs that the world wants to hear from the Beach Boys. This song is called Honkin' Down the Highway, Amid gyrating carnival-esque synthesizers, Brian sings about running away with a girl. Oddly enough, the girl's parents seem okay with this and might even have initiated the whole thing. I'm sure this isn't how Brian intended these lyrics to be read, but I interpret these lines. I interpret that as meaning the song's narrator wasn't really too keen on dating the girl, and this was almost an arranged relationship that he got pressured into. That's just like my tongue-in-cheek headcanon about the thing. Hunkin' Down the Highway has a few interesting chord changes, reminding us that despite all the chaos in his life at the time, Brian was and is still a very talented musician. And then we get to Ding Dang. Regularly described in interviews with Brian as the album's centerpiece, his favorite song on the album, and one of the most underrated Beach Boys songs, I am now going to play the entirety of Ding Dang for you without talking over it or manipulating the audio or anything. Just pure, unprocessed Ding Dang. That's it! That's Ding Dang! That's what Brian considers one of the best songs he's ever done! Now, Ding Dang is unique on Love You in more ways than one, but one of its funniest details is that it's the only song on Love You that Brian co-wrote with another famous musician outside the Beach Boys. Roger McGinn, the frontman of the Byrds, is credited as co-writer on Ding Dang. Now, you know the Byrds, even if you don't think you do. That's the Byrds. The Byrds and the Beach Boys had a lot of parallels. They're both Southern California bands that used lush harmonies and chiming guitars and reached the height of their popularity in the mid-60s. It makes sense that they would collaborate at some point, but I doubt anyone expected it to be like this. The story of how Ding Dang was made is thus. Once upon a mid-70s midnight clear, Brian Wilson, fat, drunk, and wearing a bathrobe, showed up on Roger McGinn's doorstep begging for amphetamines and wanting to write a song. He said he already had a groove in mind for it and demonstrated it on McGinn's piano. It was inspired by the folk song Shortening Bread, which might rival Be My Baby as Brian's favorite song. McGinn, hoping that if he humored Brian he would go away, but definitely not taking this song seriously, offered up a couplet off the top of his head. I love a girl, and I love her so madly. I treat her so fine, but she treats me so badly. Brian thought the lyric was brilliant and sang it again and again and again. McGinn went back to bed, hoping that Brian would be gone in the morning, but he wasn't. He was still at the piano, still playing what had become Ding Dang, having never budged from where he had been last night. I love that so much. I love the mental image of Roger McGinn getting exasperated at this one-time pop music innovator who had shown up unannounced at his house. I love the idea that this encounter is such a fond memory for Brian that he still considers Ding Dang one of his best songs. And of course, I love living in a world where the only known collaboration between the Byrds and the Beach Boys doesn't have any gorgeous harmonies, no soft ringing guitar riffs, no emotional or romantic lyrics. It's 1 minute long and sounds like that. The next song is called Solar System, and I'm not gonna offer any prizes to the people who guess what it's about. It sounds like the work of a precocious third grader who has decided to give his presentation about the solar system in song form. Brian has given at least three different origin stories for this song, saying that it was inspired by a stained glass window of Stars and Planets at the Brother Records studio where the Beach Boys recorded most of their 70s albums, or that it was inspired by a weekly astrology class he took at UCLA, which there's absolutely no record of, or that it was simply inspired by him looking up into the sky. Either way, just like how Johnny Carson is just about Johnny Carson, Solar System is just about the solar system. And you know what, Brian? If you want to write a song about the solar system, ain't nobody stopping you. Long ago, when I wanted to be a singer-songwriter and start a band, which indirectly led me to start a podcast instead, I once pretentiously announced that I would never write a song about love or politics because that's what all songs are about. Why not write a song about the solar system? Brian also pulls off the rare homonym rhyme in here. Neptune is god of the sea, Pluto is too far to see. At this point, Love You takes the most unexpected turn it could possibly take. It gets good. Okay, it's not like the album up to this point is bad. It's unusual, but once again, everything on the first side of Love You speaks more truly to Brian's mental state than any commercial, easily digestible music could. The next three songs, though, simultaneously offer a window into Brian's life at the time and describe it in really gorgeous, touching ways. They are, without a doubt, the best three songs Brian ever completely wrote. Once again, he hardly ever wrote his own lyrics, except on Love You. The Night Was So Young, which we're listening to now, has evocative lyrics and a beautiful synth atmosphere that creates what I'd describe as a foggy early morning. Tonight asleep in my bed, I think of her eyes and it makes me. Hear that? It sounds like sitting on your roof watching the sun rise through the mist. It was written about Brian's mistress, Debbie Keel, who he considered one of the few people he could really confide in. It's as raw and direct as something like Johnny Carson, but instead of writing about whatever is floating in his stream of consciousness, Brian is pouring his heart out. He didn't do that on Pet Sounds, because remember, the lyrics on Pet Sounds were written by Tony Asher, who had previously mostly done advertising jingles. Brian directed Asher what to write about, and Asher wrote it more eloquently than Brian ever could, but those weren't Brian's own thoughts. In this run of three songs, Brian grapples with himself for the first and only time in his career. Next in this trilogy is I'll Bet He's Nice, which I already played to introduce Love You. It's a breakup song, but a self-pitying one, in which Brian is jealous of his lover's new boyfriend and blames himself. It's far more complicated than most of the sentiments on Love You, and suggests that Brian really did recognize the disaster he'd become, and wanted to be released from it. The run of three profound, soul-searching, Pet Sounds-caliber songs concludes with Let's Put Our Hearts Together, which is notable for being the only released song on which Brian and his wife, Marilyn Ravel, who was also a singer and fronted a band called American Spring, share lead vocals. The relationship between this song and The Night Was So Young is interesting, to say the least. Let's Put Our Hearts Together is a heartfelt tribute to Brian's marriage, sung by both of them. The Night Was So Young is a heartfelt tribute to Brian's mistress. Together, they're the most touching songs on the album. Brian thanks them both for playing different roles in getting him through his mental doldrums. Debbie Keel is portrayed as Brian's confidant who keeps him happy. Marilyn Ravel is Brian's rock who keeps him sane. Debbie and Marilyn knew about each other, and I think they recognized that they were both helping Brian equally. They tolerated each other's presence in Brian's life because both of them loved Brian and didn't want to see him sink any further. Then, jarringly, we get to what I consider the creepiest song on Love You. Move aside, roller skating child. This song is called I Wanna Pick You Up, and it's either about an uncomfortably sexualized baby or an uncomfortably infantilized adult. I guess the baby interpretation is a little better, since most of the song seems to be directly about raising a baby, and the only part that it's easy to read as being sexual is this repeated line at the end about patting her on her butt, which, to be fair, is something that people do with babies. But Brian didn't have an infant daughter in 1977, and interviews have shown that he clearly backs the infantilized adult interpretation of the song. In one of the only interviews with Brian from right around the time Love You was released, he says it's, quote, a man who considers this chick a baby, and he wants to pretend that she is small like a baby. So, aish. Given that most of this song is dedicated to baby metaphors, that's definitely worse than it actually being about a baby. There are moments of clarity on Love You, where Brian realizes the state he's in, and that his bandmates and lovers are there for him. And then there's shit like I Wanna Pick You Up. It's the only song I regularly skip when I listen to Love You. Not that it isn't as clear a window into Brian's soul as the previous three songs are, it's just a very uncomfortable one. The second to last song is Airplane, which, keeping with the theme, is just about flying on an airplane. No more, no less. The album ends with the awkwardly titled Love Is a Woman, which is as perfect an album closer as Let Us Go On This Way is an album opener. Love Is a Woman seems to consist of Brian offering the listener dating advice, and Brian himself is a bit more vague. It's about everybody, about everything, about how things are, end quote. But it's a perfect finale because it sounds almost show-tune-ish despite the buzzing synthesizers. You can picture the lights going up and the cast joining hands to take a bow to this song. It's the only song on Love You where Brian seems to be talking directly to the listener, so it feels almost like a fourth wall break. As if Brian is saying, I've made my career singing about girls, so now that the show is over, you, listener, go out and get a girl of your own. It's like the end credits song to the career of the Beach Boys.
Life is for the living.
And yet, things came after it. Love You was the last great Beach Boys album, but not the last Beach Boys album. As soon as Love You came out, Brian began working on another Brian-centric follow-up. It was going to be called Adult Child, after the psychotherapist Eugene Landy's description of Brian, and just like Love You, it was going to take the Beach Boys in a totally new, different, un-Beach Boys-like direction. But instead of synthesizers, Adult Child had a Sinatra-esque big band swing sound to it. Adult Child's lyrics, once again fully written by Brian, took every trope of Love You up to 11. The random songs were more random. There was a song about waiting in line for a movie, a song about eating healthy, and a song that began with the line, a cigarette butt when you throw it in the water, goes The creepy songs were creepier. Look up Hey Little Tomboy, or better yet, don't. The emotional songs were more emotional. Adult Child's closing track, Still I Dream of It, is haunting and incredibly, viscerally sad. I'll only play a short snippet of it here, but this is clearly one of the most directly autobiographical songs Brian ever wrote.
Time for supper now. Day's been hard and I'm so tired, I feel like eating now.
Adult Child was never released. Mike Love considered it way too weird to have the Beach Boys name on it, and for the only time in his career, he may have been right. Adult Child has been widely bootlegged by fans, but it's bad, and it's not charmingly offbeat because it's bad the way Love You is. It's just a sad testimonial to how far Brian had fallen. So ended Brian Wilson's brief, attempted comeback. Mike Love was now the undisputed leader of the Beach Boys, and as Brian went into residential treatment for his many addictions and panoply of other issues, Mike took the Beach Boys on tour, releasing a string of shittier and shittier albums throughout the 80s, all while selling out stadiums and making millions of dollars. In his eyes, vindicating his belief that his version, of the Beach Boys was the one people wanted. Eugene Landy was given conservatorship over Brian and became increasingly controlling, refusing to let Brian out of his sight and allegedly threatening him with a baseball bat. He even ghost wrote an autobiography credited to Brian. Brian's brother Carl and Brian's now adult children fought a years-long legal battle to get Brian freed from Landy's control, eventually concluding in the state of California, revoking Landy's medical license in 1989. Landy continued to manage Brian's business assets, having de facto control over his back catalog of songs, until Brian successfully got a restraining order in 1992. Brian has recovered somewhat since then. He revisited Smile in 2004, cobbling together his old recordings into something like what a finished version of the album might have been. He's put out a few decent solo albums in the 2000s and 2010s. He toured a few times. He and Mike even briefly buried the hatchet in 2012 for one final album and tour under the Beach Boys' name. That's Why God Made the Radio. And it's a surprisingly good album. It's not a late-period classic, like, say, David Bowie's Black Star, but it sure is better than I'd have expected it to be after all these years of no music worth listening to coming from the Beach Boys. In fact, it's probably the best album any Beach Boy has been involved in since Well, love you. Where does that leave love you? Is it okay to like love you? Given that it's a product of Brian's serious mental health struggles, and any appreciation of love you necessarily involves at least a little bit of laughing at Brian's expense. Are we just gawking at him? Is this truly the Beach Boys' Sonichu album, Brian Wilson Become Lolcow? Well, that's a bigger question than I can answer in this already pretty long episode. It's a bigger question than anyone can conclusively answer. It goes beyond Brian Wilson into discussions of other tortured artists. Vincent van Gogh is probably one of the closest cultural equivalents to Brian Wilson, someone whose mental illness is considered part and parcel of their artistic genius. We admire them, we appreciate them, and we regret that once they got the help they needed, their art became far less interesting. And yet, mental illness exists. We can't sweep that under the rug. And so, maybe we're all lucky to have such a singular, uncomfortable, and yet necessary guide to it. Produced by one of the best-known musical artists of the 20th century, Brian Wilson's soul is on Love You, and it definitely isn't on anything else he put out. Everyone, regardless of your state of mental health, whether you're Tor Parsons, or Johnny Carson, or a durian with a mustache, can thank him for that.
Love is a woman, so treat her tenderly tonight. Love makes a woman, so give her all your love tonight. My advice, you just treat her nice.